Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Breaking details on that whistleblower who leaked top secret documents by the government surveillance of Americans.
The person responsible for one of the greatest national security leaks in recent American history insisted that his identity be made public after he fled the country for Hong Kong.
Snowden has been in Russia now for 3 full days.
President Putin defying the U.S., saying the Russians will not turn him over.
He damaged the security of the country.
No, I don't think Mr. Snowden was a patriot.
But this is a little bit of a misunderstanding about why I came forward. I didn't come forward to tell people how to live or what to do. The problem of 2013 was not one specifically of surveillance, but one of democracy. It was the fact that our laws had changed. The operation of our governments had changed around the world, across borders, and it happened without our knowledge, without our consent. Now, the basic principle of democracy in an open Western liberal society, one would hope at least, is that the government governs because they have a mandate that's based on the consent of the governed. If we don't know what's going on, we can't give our consent.
I called for a thorough review of our surveillance operations before Mr. Snowden made these leaks.
We're in the midst of the greatest redistribution of power since the Industrial Revolution. And this is happening because technology has provided a new capability that reaches everyone in every place. It has no regard for borders. Now, this technology allows these institutions to monitor and record the private activities of people on a scale that's broad enough that we can say it's close to all-powerful. And it's through the use of new platforms and algorithms that are built on and around these capabilities that they're able to shift our behavior. In some cases, they're able to predict our decisions and also nudge them to different outcomes. And they do this by exploiting the human need for belonging. But how many of you who have a Facebook account actually read the terms of service? Right? Like it's not anything to be ashamed of. Everything has hundreds and hundreds of pages of legal jargon that we're not qualified to read and assess, and yet they're considered to be binding upon us. And it is through this sort of unholy connection of technology sort of an unusual interpretation of contract law, that these institutions have been able to transform this greatest virtue of humanity, which is this desire to interact and to connect and to cooperate and to share, to transform all of that into a weakness. And now these institutions, which are both commercial and governmental, have built upon that and built upon that, and they have structuralized it and entrenched it to where it has become now the most effective means of social control in the history of our species. When I came forward to reveal the first system of global, truly global mass surveillance back in 2013, which was being run not just by the United States government, but actually of a group called the Five Eyes. These are the Anglophone governments, which would be the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. And the revelation of this activity, this was a collaboration between corporate and government power, and government in the United States, they would go to the largest web platforms, and they would try to induce them into willful cooperation beyond what the law required, and they would get these groups to act as agents of government, be able to hand over your entire Gmail account, everything you've ever typed into Facebook, clicked on Facebook, every site you've ever gone to where you're logged into Facebook, but it just has that like button on the page. All of that was recorded, right? And it was poured into a system that didn't just touch internet connections, but it touched phone calls and everything else. But an unusual thing is you would see a traditional adversary like Russia is actually less intensely monitored than the United States itself. Their own documents, written by their own lawyers, said that the real reason these programs were classified was because they feared a, this is their own words, quote, damaging public debate. And that's about the scale of their activities, and that would open them up to legal challenges because they know they had gone far beyond the law. By their own count, they were violating our laws thousands of times a year. I think 2,776 times in a single quarter or calendar year. I can't recall precisely. Once upon a time, if you think back to Cold War histories, or at least propaganda, we in the West distinguished ourselves from, you know, the traditional adversary nations by saying, we don't do that. We're different from the Iron Curtain. We could do that. We could spy on our own people internally, and we could spy on people who have done nothing wrong. We could do it better than them, but we don't, because it's wrong. It's contrary to our rights. It's contrary to our laws. It's contrary to our values. After September 11th, the policies of the United States changed. It's interesting and very historically important to understand that this plan for this new system of mass surveillance was not created in the wake of 9/11. In fact, it had already been written, the U.S. Patriot Act, you all may have potentially heard of, which really changed the way our surveillance and sort of counterterrorism strategies worked, had been sitting on a shelf for years, ready to go. But our legislature didn't believe they were in a position where they could pass it. But after the entire nation had been victimized, everyone was grieving and angry and fearful, it passed with, I think, only a single dissenting vote. But let's say you're one of the people who happen to be sympathetic to these. But I would argue, if you are so fearful of foreigners that you are willing to destroy your own rights, the rights of your family, the rights of everyone who lives in your country, you are not protecting anything. You are, in fact, harming. And if you want to be strong, the way that you show strength is not through fear, but by showing resilience. If you can't have faith in your country, if you can't have faith in your system that is greater than your fear of someone who doesn't look like you, I don't see that as strength. I see that as weakness. Most of the government's best hacking tools and technologies today are not developed in-house in the United States or Canada or any other country. They're actually purchased from industry, people who previously worked for government, and then they left and they developed the same kind of weapons. And then we have a new digital arms trade. But this awareness of the problem led to a new effort to resist these abuses and to create new safeguards and new protections. Before 2013, as measured by major browsers like Google, of course, their Chrome browser, something like a third of web traffic was encrypted. Less than half, right? And now, today, the last figure I saw, which I think was from the end of last year, it was nearing 90%. Now, what this means is people's communication, when you went to go check your Gmail box, in these early days, anyone between you and the server, right? They could read your email. And this worked for Facebook, right? This worked for search engines. This worked for so many different services. Since then, we've started armoring it. We've clothed ourselves as we cross this hostile path by encrypting our communications by default. But we still have the Google problem. We still have the Facebook problem, right? We still have all of these problems. Amazon runs half the internet now, even though people don't see it because it's on their web services. And what this means is you have these giant silos that are run by corporations where your communications are encrypted while they're in transit across that path, but then they're actually encrypted to Google. And when they reach that destination at a Google server, they're being encrypted with a key that Google holds. Google can now read everything because they want to mine this for data. They want to be able to sell it to their partners and, you know, do targeting against you and these kind of activities. And so they want to be able to read it, right? And if they can read it, then other people can ask them to give them a copy, right? So the government just goes to Google and says, hey, give us everything about this person, that person, so on and so forth.
I put the program in place to protect the country. One of the certainties is civil liberties were guaranteed.
We should be partner to government. It's very easy to think that nothing's changed. But it is changing. It's not changing fast enough. We haven't done enough and the problem isn't solved, but now we have a place to start.
Dopamine itself is not the reward. It's the buildup to the reward. And the reward has more of a kind of opioid bliss-like property, which itself is not bad if it's endogenous, released from within. But when we can just sit there like the rat with no dopamine, gorging ourselves with pleasures, so to speak, what you end up with is somebody that feels really unmotivated, and those pleasures no longer work to tickle those feel-good circuits. And so there's no reason for them to go out and pursue anything.
The reward itself, whatever it is, might be rewarding the first time around, but then over time, the way that we're wired will make it less reinforcing, less rewarding. So then we need a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. So ultimately, the reward itself is not the thing to seek because it's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's ever elusive.
To pursue rewards, but understand that the pursuit is actually the reward if you want to have repeated wins, okay? Pleasure experienced without prior requirement for pursuit,
yes,
is terrible for us. It's terrible for us as individuals. It's terrible for us as groups. And we are finding now, and we are going to increasingly find, that those who will be successful, young or old, are going to be those people who can create their own internal buffers. They're going to be able to control their relationship to pleasures because the proximity to pleasures and their availability is the problem. If you look at the increase in use of drugs of abuse or prescription medication, which at least at the first pass deliver pleasure, pain relief, the whole issue with the opioid crisis and dopaminergic drugs like Ritalin, Adderall, you know, there is sometimes is a clinical need, but tons of people are taking those recreationally now or to study. Huge dopamine increases are what those cause. That is a problem. That's a serious problem because it creates a cycle where you need more of that specific thing. I would say addiction is a progressive narrowing of the things that bring you pleasure.
God, that's...
It's like a nature's cruel trick in the modern ecosystem because it, you know, essentially turns us all into people with addiction because we have everything. So that constant pursuit, that never being, you know, satisfied with what we have, with always wanting more, you know, gets us into this trap of compulsive overconsumption or addiction.
We often think about the extremes of addiction, and those are really severe, but we also have to think about the more subtle forms of something we really love, but indulging in it just a little too often so that it no longer has that edge. You know, there have been really good studies of people who jump out of airplanes with parachutes. You know, I'm sure it's a lot of fun. It looks like a thrill, but people do it over and over and over again, often die doing other things. They often become drug addicts.
because it's a huge high. Oh yeah. Yeah. A lot of that.
Interesting.
And you know, there are a lot of examples of this. I mean, you can get addicted to anything. The key is to regulate that behavior. So you asked what should people do? Well, certainly I'm trying this now, and I have some good examples. Some young people I know and work with are taking breaks from not just social media, but no cell phone whatsoever. I'm actually trying an odd experiment, which is for the first hour of every day, no phone. Right. So we have circuitry in the brain related to the so-called basal ganglia, and we have go, so activating, you know, think gas pedal. And then there's a lot of no-go circuitry, and learning how to keep that no-go, don't circuitry, as we could call it, tuned up is very important. And so many times throughout the day, but I try and get 25 a day where I actively refrain from doing something that I impulsively want to do. Could be looking at my phone, but it could even be something trivial. Like I want to walk to the kitchen and get a glass of water. So I'm actively engaging in denial, not cognitive denial, in action-based denial. So restricting my behavior in some way as a way of keeping these dopamine circuits tuned up. Also not looking at my phone first thing in the morning for an hour, because knowing what we now know about the second phase of sleep and REM sleep being more predominant in the second wave of sleep, and the fact that you're working through a lot of emotional and logistical contingencies, you're reshaping your brain in sleep. That's when neuroplasticity occurs, during sleep. It's triggered in wakefulness, but it actually takes place in sleep, especially that second half of sleep. When you wake up in the morning, you are in a perfect position to what I call receive the download of all the work that your neural circuitry has been doing the night before. But if you immediately go to a sensory experience, especially a rich sensory experience of stuff scrolling by, you're actually missing the information that you processed at night. And even more importantly, that second half of the night during REM sleep is when the emotional weight of things becomes, let's say, you put it on the shelf properly. Things that are important to emotionally register get put in one shelf. Things that were like the comment you got on Twitter that was triggering doesn't seem like such a big deal after a good night's sleep. And that's because that second half of sleep is actually when you re-experience these things, but your body can't secrete adrenaline. It's kind of an internal form of therapy or even trauma therapy. And that's why people who don't get that sleep are very, you know, they're easily agitated. They feel like the world is crushing down on them. So when I wake up in the morning, I want to receive ideas that I want to learn from my learning. And if you take in new information, you are not in a position to do that.
You know, our dopamine, it's a signal, right? We do something, it feels good. Our brain releases dopamine. It says, do that thing again. And then we go into a dopamine deficit state. And then that says, oh, you know, that's a very powerful physiologic drive that insists that we pursue that thing again, even when we stop liking it. So that's the vicious cycle. But your solution to this modern problem, and it's a modern problem that we all have, is to seek more, to try harder, to find the road with the most friction and go there.
Many people find it hard to subjectively attach dopamine to something they don't want to do. How do you get motivated? Well, one way to do that is if you are good at subjectively attaching dopamine to the pursuit, just knowing, okay, I really am hungry for this. I'm going to tell myself that, making it 1% of the way is a success, and I'm going to keep going and I'm going to keep ratcheting on. And that's great if you can do that. But for people that can't do that, understanding this relationship with the pleasure pain balance can be more powerful. Just understanding the more friction and pain that you experience, the greater the dopamine reward you will get later. And that serves as its own amplifier of the whole process of pursuing more dopamine. You're balancing the dopamine and epinephrine systems. You know, epinephrine being this molecule of universal currency of energy output. It could be out of hate or it could be out of love. Epinephrine doesn't care. And actually dopamine doesn't care. None of these systems care about us. They just work underneath our conscious control. But when you start to understand that hitting the gas pedal is great, but hitting the gas pedal and then coming off the gas pedal a little bit, you can kind of sit in a more relaxed RPM, actually allows you to go much further. You're balancing the dopamine and epinephrine systems.
We'll probably look back giving a 13-year-old social media the same way that we look today at giving a 13-year-old a pack of cigarettes, because we're learning that the brain at that point really can't handle the forces that are unleashed by these sort of highly optimized tools, which are built to exploit psychological vulnerabilities in order to get a lot of uses, just like we artificially increase the nicotine content in the tobacco and cigarettes because we wanted people to smoke more. There seems to be, from the most recent research literature, sort of one distinctly positive thing from social media and two distinctly negative. So the two distinctly negative things is, they call it social snacking, but essentially you replace actual high quality face-to-face interaction, the type of connections that you need to thrive as a social being, you replace it with a low friction interaction online, and it's not a fair trade. The second issue is social comparison. So it's just not healthy for us to constantly be looking at these carefully curated positive portrayals of everyone's life. We're not wired for it. And so that also makes us less happy. So those are probably the two leading drivers for why we see these correlations with increased social media use and less happiness, and less sociality. So this behavior of constantly looking at the phone is not intrinsic to this technology. In fact, we had both social media and smartphones for years before it became normal to look at your phone all the time. The reason we do that, and this is the behavior that's causing all these issues, the reason we do that is that around the point when the major social media platforms were preparing for their IPOs, they completely re-engineered the social media experience. So instead of it being about posting and reading your friend's post, it became about this steady incoming stream of social approval indicators, like likes, retweets, comments. And so now you had a reason to keep going back to the phone, because every time you hit this, there might be another reward there, another indication of social approval. None of that was in the original social media model, but they added it because it changed it from something you checked every once in a while to something that you checked all the time, and it was really hard to resist. And then that changed our entire relationship with these devices. And so now we think about it as something we look at all the time. It sort of trained us to think of it like this constant companion that we always need to be looking at in every downtime. But that's very recent, and it's very contrived, and it's causing a lot of trouble. Well, I mean, a lot of these studies are correlational. You're looking at different generations, you're looking at different birth years, and you're trying to understand, in general, why is that population different? So when it came to teenagers and mental health, there was this sort of off-the-charts moment, where the demographers that measure different properties of different generations, when they got to this Generation Z, the first generation to have ubiquitous access to smartphones starting their adolescence, these mental health issues increased more rapidly than anything they'd ever seen before increased between any generation.
Whoa.
So it was literally off the charts. Like, they don't see changes. Usually the changes between generations is much more gradual. And so you get to this birth year in the 90s that puts you at the smartphone era in your early adolescence, and that goes up. Wow. Right? And so they're trying to figure out why, but like any good demographers, you see there could be a lot of different issues, so there could be a lot of different conjectures. And so they explored a lot of different things. But the timing wasn't working out for other things. They thought, well, maybe it has to do with, you know, the Great Recession and economic anxiety. But that started earlier. And this didn't start till a little bit later. And they're like, well, maybe it's like political stuff and everyone's stressed out. But no, that's much later. That comes much later. So they're really trying to figure this out. And they said, well, maybe it's self-reporting. Okay, so maybe, yes, it's true that starting at this birth year, people report anxiety-related disorders, but we've just become more used to that, and so maybe just people are more comfortable. But then they looked at the hospitalization data, and hospitalizations for self-harm went right up with it, right? So it's not a reporting error. And so what you see is this sort of narrowing of consensus around the idea that there's really no other explanation that fits the data as well as giving social media to adolescents. That's what's causing it. The question is, how do we improve our relationship more generally with technology in our personal life? And so the philosophy that I teach is digital minimalism, which just takes minimalism, which has been around forever. It's an ancient idea. You should focus on the things that are really, really valuable to the exclusion of other things that are much less valuable. So by putting your attention on the things that you know for sure give you big wins, and concentrate intensely on them, you can do better than taking that same attention and trying to spread it over many more things that also give you smaller wins. So if you apply this to your digital life, what you get is a approach to the apps and the services and the gadgets that says, I only want to use digital tools that give me really big returns on a small number of things I really care about. and I'm happy missing out on everything else. Which is a completely different way of thinking about it than I think most people have thought about their personal digital life, which is much more of a maximalist mindset. Hey, this thing might bring me some value or some convenience, and I don't want to miss out on that. So I might as well try it out, or I might as well download that app, or I might as well sign up for it. This sort of more haphazard approach. The digital minimalists say, no. I know what I'm all about. I know what I want to do with my time. I know what's important to me. And I put tech to work incredibly strategically to help those things I really care about, and then everything else that's out there, I just ignore. Well, I mean, attention residue is the killer for almost any creative endeavor. And it comes out of the psychology literature. If you're focused on something difficult, and then you shift your attention over to something else, and even if it's for 1 minute, right, like you shift over to look at an email or whatever, and then you come back to the original hard thing, there's a residue left from that context switch. And that residue takes a while to clear out. And until it clears out, your cognitive performance has declined. And so the problem is the way that a lot of us work today, when we bring on more and more demands, or that we're really plugged into email or social media or what have you, is that we're constantly doing these quick checks. And we feel like, hey, we're doing the right thing. I don't have this window open at the same time as this window. I'm not multitasking anymore. I've got it all figured out. But what we're not realizing is the context switch of each of these quick checks is creating attention residue. Solitude is freedom from input from other minds. So it has nothing to do with physical isolation. I mean, in this room, you could certainly be in solitude if you were just alone with your own thoughts, but if you're up on a mountaintop, completely isolated, but have earbuds in, right? You're not in solitude. So it's nothing to do with physical isolation. It's what mode your brain is in. So if your brain is processing input that was generated from another mind, you're not in solitude. And if it's not, it's just observing or thinking its own thoughts. You are in a state of solitude. And what we know is that solitude is crucial. You have to have this on a regular basis in your life if you're gonna flourish and thrive as a human being. Now, this wasn't a problem until about 7 years ago, because it was unavoidable that you were gonna have solitude just going about your day-to-day business, right? You'd be in the car, you didn't like was on the radio, solitude. You're in line at the drugstore and you have to wait 10 minutes, it's solitude. But for the first time in human history, we've created the technology that makes it possible to banish every last moment of solitude from your life, because now you have ubiquitous high-speed wireless internet and the supercomputer in your pocket, and there's big back-end algorithms that will feed up to you a sort of optimized selection of nuggets at any moment. The problem with that is it gets all solitude out of your life, creating a syndrome called solitude deprivation syndrome, which we're not really wired for. And it makes us anxious, it impedes our development, it impedes our creative and professional insights. It's not good. You know, in digital minimalism, I'm so concerned about people being very blithe about how they're gonna change what sociality means. Like, I'm gonna do things on my phone now, I'm gonna be doing streaks on Snapchat and selfies, and like, let's just completely change, you know, what it means to be social. That has big impacts, because we know, we've known since the ancients, that what you need to also feel like a flourishing, thriving human being is you have to take responsibility for and sacrifice on behalf of family, close friends, and community. Can't just do that. It has to be, I am connected and serving the people in my immediate orbit. We need that as well to flourish. So in your work, focusing to do really good things. And in your social life, focusing to actually be there and serve and sacrifice for family, close friends, and community. This is like an ancient formula for flourishing as a human being. A lot of recent tech has inadvertently pushed us away from those things.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The secret to visibly firmer, summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dull, dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Rich yet never greasy, Andaria Algae Body Oil is formulated with sustainably sourced seaweed to help replenish the skin's moisture barrier and 7 nourishing active botanical oils for results you can see and feel all over. The best part? Its signature scent. A blend of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. This all-natural scent is unforgettable. Everything Osea makes is clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.